you're listening, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. This is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. It's Saturday, May 17th, and I am calling you from Oakland, and it's a little overcast today, and we've had a lot of hot weather here, but this is California, and the weather changes. Today, we are talking about religion. As a person who was raised a Protestant, who constantly questioned the Bible, who was constantly in trouble with the Sunday school teachers, this is a fascinating subject for me, our next guest. The information in the Bible is something that I questioned from a very young person, so young age, and it is thought to be historical. There are references given by many people that the Jesus of Nazareth was a true person who lived and spoke the gospel, and it was written down, and it's what people focus on now. It's what churches are based on. Our guest today is Daniel Unterbrink, and his book is called Judas of Nazareth. And this is what they say about the book. This is the promo. Matching the events depicted in the New Testament with the historically verifiable events in Josephus' history, Unterbrink pushes the dating of Jesus back nearly a generation to revolutionary time in ancient Judea. He shows that the real historical Jesus, the physical man behind the fictional stories in Paul's gospel, was Judas of Galilee, a Masonic pretender of Torah-observant revolutionary bent on overthrowing the Roman government and galvanizing the Jewish people behind his vision of the coming kingdom of God. In the greatest cover-up of history, this teacher of first-century Israel was replaced by the literary creation known as Jesus of Nazareth. Let me just tell you a little bit about our guest today. Daniel T. Unterbrink is the author of Judas of Galilee, New Testament Lies, and the Three Messiahs. He's a retired forensic auditor. He has turned his analytical prowess to the historical origins of Christianity. He lives in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to the program, Dan.
Hi, how are you doing, Cliff?
I'm great. I'm really glad to have you. So, I was looking in your background, and it looks like you've written a few books on Jesus. Tell us what the focus is of this book and why it's different than the other books on the so-called Messiah.
Okay, well, first of all, I got interested in writing the first book, Judas the Galilean, because I was looking at the birth narratives of Jesus of Nazareth in the Gospels. In one, he was born in 4 B.C., and in the other, he's born in 6 A.D. So I went to the historian Josephus, and I looked to see what was going on in those time periods, and there was a fellow named Judas the Galilean that in 4 B.C. Cleansed the temple and was later released in a Barabbas-style prisoner release. And then in 6 A.D., he led a tax revolt against the Romans. So He's the most famous person in the first century A.D. in Judea, but yet nobody knows about him. And his life matches up with what Jesus of Nazareth supposedly did. So I started from there, and I went through the book of Josephus. It's a history of the Jewish nation. And just to see, you know how many times he's mentioned, his sons are mentioned, his grandsons mentioned. Every time that Josephus talked about, you know, the sons and the grandson, he always referred back to this great teacher, Judas the Galilean. Mm-hmm. Yet, there's nothing in his writings about Jesus of Nazareth. Something, and, you know, number one, either Jesus was incredibly unimportant, or possibly this Judas the Galilean was the basis for Jesus of Nazareth. So that was how I first got interested in it. And then you can't only do that, but then you have to look at the life of Paul. And there's also a character named Saul in Josephus's writings that essentially is doing the same things that Paul's doing, except he's a much more sinister character.
Mm-hmm.
So you put those two things together, and then you get the creation of the Jesus of Nazareth movement that happened after the Jewish War in 70 AD. So I try to go, through each area and describe what was going on and the conflicts that were going on between the different movements.
Okay, so let's talk about your primary sources. And your book, by the way, is extremely well researched. It's quite a read. But I think it's important to kind of discuss your sources. So Josephus, his writings were the primary focus of a lot of the book. Can you tell us a little bit about him and what he documents on the Jesus figure?
Okay, he essentially lived between 30 AD and about 90 AD, and he wrote his histories of the history of Israel based on what was in the Old Testament plus his own experiences. He was actually involved in the Jewish War. Okay, so he's writing these histories later. So he has a kind of a firsthand information or knowledge of what's going on at the time. He writes absolutely, the only passage that is attributed to him that speaks of Jesus of Nazareth is inserted into his document in Antiquities, and it's the only thing, and it talks about Jesus' death. But he doesn't write anything about his life, his history, there's nothing. And this is the exact same spot that you would expect him to have talked about Judas the Galilean's death. Because before that, he talks about Judas the Galilean, about, that the nation followed him, and he was this wonder, fabulous teacher, but yet he omits his death. But yet, what I think happened, I think later Christians took the death of Judas the Galilean and transformed it into the death of Jesus of Nazareth. Because it doesn't make sense the way it's written. And most historians do not accept the one message, the one mention of Jesus of Nazareth in Josephus's writings.
Well, so, he's a primary chronicler of that period. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, he's the one that puts down the actual history of what. Now he did have his biases, but yet, he put down the years, and you can follow the actual chronology of the first century go by through his writings.
Mm-hmm.
So he's okay. Very important to understand the whole gist of what's going on.
So if there was a true Jesus of Nazareth, he would have and he was as outspoken as the Bible makes him appear, Josephus would have definitely documented it.
Oh, that would have been, he would have loved it, because anything that was different or unusual, he puts in the writings. Because, he's kind of sensationalizing things, too. So if you had a person as fabulous as the Gospel Jesus, he would have written about him in detail. But yet he doesn't mention him at all. And he doesn't mention term Christian at all.
He doesn't.
Which is interesting, too.
So does he chronicle Judas?
Oh, yeah. He does it from the year 4 B.C., and his movement essentially ends in 70. You've heard of the Masada, where the Jewish rebels all commit suicide? Well, Judas the Galilean's grandson was the leader at Masada. So for a period of almost 80 years, Judas was the center of the resistance movement. His movement was up against the Herodians and the Romans. So his movement was the one movement that was it was an insurgence against the ruling elites. So his was everything. There was no Jesus of Nazareth is never mentioned, or such a movement like what is described in the New Testament.
The amazing thing of about the cover of your book, Judas of Nazareth, is that most people consider Judas, the whole word Judas brings up Antichrist, anti-Jesus kind of a focus, because he's portrayed as the person who gives Jesus away in the Bible. And yet you claim that he is the true person that the Bible is written about.
Okay, well, Judas the Galilean is not to be confused with Judas Iscariot.
Okay.
See, Judas Iscariot was an invented character that was invented post-70 AD.
Oh, so he was invented too?
He was invented too. There was no such character as Judas Iscariot.
Okay. Oh my God.
What Judas Iscariot is a play on Judas being a representation of the Jews, and Iscariot is a garbling of Sicarios, which is a segment of Judas the Galilean's movement. So essentially, okay, the person that wrote the book of Mark was saying that the Jewish movement, they're the ones that betrayed the Jesus of Nazareth that they're depicting in the Gospel of Mark. And to get ahead of myself, I claim with good support that Paul is the one that wrote the Gospel of Mark, and his Jesus of Nazareth is a blending of Judas the Galilean and himself. So you're going to get a lot of the Paul coming through in the New Testament.
But go ahead.
I was going to say, if you look at the life of Paul, which is important, you got to remember his gospel, and this is what he claims himself. He said that his gospel he received by revelation from the risen Christ, and he had nothing to do. He wasn't taught it by anyone. He didn't get it from anyone. It was a revelation from the risen Christ. Now, when you consider that versus the actual disciples of the Messiah, he was in direct competition with them. And if you read his documents in that light, you see that he is creating his own little gospel, his own little movement that is totally separate from the Jewish Jesus movement that is going on in Israel.
You know, it's amazing how much storytelling goes on in the Bible. Why is you document that a lot of this is storytelling, and I don't know, it feels like it's manipulation. It's storytelling to heighten a movement, a religious movement. Do you find a reason for this, or is it just kind of a building of a character to build the foundations for a church or for a religious sect? I mean, what would you say about that?
Well, I think you got to remember now. Most historians think Paul died in the mid 60s. Okay, and I have a chapter that says that he was actually alive and well in the late 60s, probably wrote the Gospel of Mark, okay, which is much different than most historians, but I back it up with the passages from Josephus and such. Paul, when the Jewish Jesus movement, in the war with Rome, they're completely crushed. Rome destroys Jerusalem, they destroy the temple, there's nothing left. Most of them are dead. So you have this vacuum now that Paul can go in and create his own religion. Now, you know that most religions can capture vast amounts of wealth through contributions. And Paul was doing this earlier while he was still a member of the Jewish Jesus movement back in the 40s. But then he eventually is expelled from the movement, so it's not until 70 when the whole Jesus movement is destroyed that he can create this new person named Jesus of Nazareth, which is essentially breathing his own gospel into a created figure.
So you're saying that that's created to develop the foundations for a movement, a church movement, which they can use to prosper or what? What is your feeling?
It's not a whole lot different than what goes on today, you know, where people can preach the word and people give money. Paul, in Josephus's writings, this Saul becomes a very powerful figure in the 60s. He had collected a lot of money back in the 40s from his churches. So now he's rubbing elbows not only with King Agrippa, but he goes to meet Nero. So, you know, he's rubbing elbows with some of the most powerful people in the world. So
yes.
That didn't come about by being a poor, a tanner or whatever. That came about because he had collected huge sums of money and kept it for himself.
My God. Okay, let's go on, and we're working on your primary sources for historical Jesus. So we finish with Josephus. Let's talk about Suetonius and Tacitus. Tell me about that source.
Suetonius and Tacitus both wrote back in about 120 A.D. So
are these Romans or are these Jews?
These are two Roman historians, and one reason why most historians today consider them primary sources is that they really didn't have any agenda to promote or criticize a Christian movement. So what they're doing is just kind of telling the reader what they know, and they don't say a whole lot about Christians. Suetonius simply says that he mentions this Jewish group at the instigation of Crestus, or Christ, created disturbances all over the place, so they were expelled from Rome. So here we have a Christian movement, according to Suetonius, that was Jewish, and they were troublemakers. And this describes the Judas the Galileans movement, not a Gospel Jesus movement. Gospel Jesus is a Pacific Christ. He's you know, all loving and everything. Judas the Galilean was bent on overthrowing Roman rule in Judea. They were nationalists. So Suetonius is one. He has actually two passages, very minor, but they point to a revolutionary type of a Jewish person following a Messiah figure.
Okay, and then now the other, Suetonius. Mm-hmm. But
okay,
was that post or was that pre or post war? Suetonius
It happened after the Jewish War. They wrote it after the Jewish War, but they're referring to events before the Jewish War.
Okay.
So when Suetonius, when he's talking about the rebellious Jews, this was probably in the 40s. Okay. Now, when Tacitus writes, he writes about the Great Fire in Rome. And I don't know if you've ever seen movies where the Rome burns down. I think Peter Ustinov played Nero in the movies. And the scapegoat for that were the Christians. Now, it just depends. What do you think? What is meant by the term Christian? Now, I told you that Josephus never used the term Christian. He always used the term zealot or sicarii. The Roman historians don't use the term zealot or sicarii. They use the term Christian. Okay, so, and essentially, even a great scholar like Edward Gibbon, who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, conjectured that the people that were persecuted under Nero after the Great Fire were the followers of Judas the Galilean. Because he said that it wouldn't have made any sense for Nero to persecute a loving group like the Christians as described through the fantasy of the New Testament.
Okay.
So those are, and that's the only mention of Christians or Christianity by Tacitus. So really, the Roman historians, and you can see why they don't say much, you know, Israel was a kind of a backwater, and it wasn't really part of their focus on telling the history of Rome. So that's all we know from them. Not a whole lot.
Okay. And then, so that's the Roman perspective post-Jewish war. And then we get to this other figure, Pliny the Younger.
Okay.
So what was his contribution?
Okay, now he's a little different in that he's writing at about the same time as Tacitus and Suetonius. But Tacitus and Suetonius were talking about Christians before the war with Rome, where they were all, they were talking about the Jewish Christians. Okay? Pliny is talking about the Christians of his day in 120 AD. Okay? And he distinguishes those Christians from what the genuine Christians were, which would have been the Christians that Tacitus and Suetonius were talking about. So he kind of distinguishes between the Christians that were willing to die for their religion, which is what Tacitus is talking about, and the other Christians, as soon as they're in trouble, they just denounced their faith and said, we didn't know what we were doing, because they didn't want to be put to death. So if you read the documents, and I have them in the book, it becomes very clear that there's two distinct movements going on. There was the Jewish movement, and these people were zealots. They were fanatics, and they were gonna die for what they believed in. And then there were the Gentile followers of Paul that they might have believed, but I don't think too many of them were willing to die for what they believed. A little different tone.
Okay, so I'm working through your research here, because at some point we're going to kind of crystallize how this, I'm going to call it a fable of Jesus of Nazareth, was formed. So let's talk, tell me about Paul's letters and how that is a contribution, because he wrote extensively, right?
Yeah, he did, and actually his letters are the first documents written. He wrote his letters somewhere in the 30s and early 40s. Okay, mm-hmm. So while Josephus didn't write till the 70s up to the 90s, so the actual earliest documentation of anything related to Christianity came from Paul. So,
okay, now who's Paul? Are we talking Paul, one of the disciples, Paul?
Okay, Paul, there was, in Josephus's writing, he talks about a character named Saul. Okay, now even in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, Paul is initially called Saul.
Hmm.
Okay, and in the book of Acts, Saul is introduced after the stoning of Stephen. Okay, and that occurs somewhere around 35 A.D. Josephus's writings, Saul comes onto the scene after the stoning of James, which is in 62 A.D. The difference in that account is the book of Acts took one event and put it into another time frame, because Josephus is talking about Saul doing something that is very evil, and he is persecuting the Christians after the stoning of Jesus' own brother, James. And that's in 62 A.D. That's after he's been removed from the Jesus movement. Okay, mm-hmm. So here you have the genesis for the traitor, which was Saul. Okay?
Okay.
What they do is they put it back, the author of Acts puts that back in time, where they make the evil Saul persecute the Christians before he becomes a member of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why they got around, dealing with the actual history of this character named Saul, because he originally converts to the Jesus movement, spends about 17 to 20 years in the movement, then he comes up with his own gospel. Eventually they find him out, and James and Peter remove him from the movement. And at that point, he is the liar, the enemy, and then he becomes the traitor to the movement. So all these things that were attached to Saul have now been, a lot of it's been attached to Judas Iscariot and, you know, other characters throughout history.
I'll tell you, there's so much going on, it gets confusing very quickly.
I think I've tried to set it out where you're looking at the historical documents first, and then I look at the life of Paul and look all that. Then I go into the gospel formation, showing how what Paul has preached in his letters has now become the focus of the Jewish Messiah, which really isn't true, because the Jews threw him out of the movement because of what he was teaching.
Wow.
He was teaching against the law, and the Jewish Jesus movement were in favor of the law. So it's
just amazing. It's just, there's so, it's just layer after layer. I thought it was interesting, in the book you actually give a short reference to the Dead Sea Scrolls and some of the traditions. What did you find in relation to the Jesus of Nazareth within the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Well, Robert Eisenman has done a lot of, he's a scholar that first got the Dead Sea Scrolls released to the public. He's done a lot of work showing that some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the materials, relate to what's going on in early Christianity. Mm. And it's also interesting that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found at Masada, which was the stronghold of Judas the Galilean's movement with the Sakkara.
Right.
So it's like we know that the Zealots and the Sakkara were using the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they had control of that information. It's interesting that Paul also uses the Dead Sea Scroll ideas, but he usually turns them 180 degrees he twists them to make his own points, which would have driven the actual followers of the Dead Sea Scrolls crazy, because he really does some harm. But, you know, he's trying to develop his own movement and to make the Gentiles the new Israel.
So the Dead Sea Scroll material that you found just kind of correlates to the time period, would you say?
Well, it's not only the time period, but it's the idea of being following the law to be a movement of righteousness, you know, to live a holy life. It wasn't just believe in this or believe in that. It was actually to be something, you know.
Okay.
That was the focus of the early Jesus movement.
Okay. Now, I've read other books on the various Jewish movements that were going on during the time of the so-called Christ. And you have a section called, and you actually describe the Jewish Jesus movement. Can you describe that a little bit for our audience, how that is important? Because I think that kind of crystallizes why a fable would be created after the wars to kind of create a new church.
Okay. Now, first of all, the Jewish Jesus movement is just an easy way for me to distinguish between the Jews that were following Judas the Galilean versus the Gentiles who were following Paul's gospel, because I call his movement the Gentile Christ movement. So you've got the Jewish Jesus movement, which was the original, and then you have the Paul's Christ movement, the Gentile Christ movement, which is kind of came onto the scene 20 or 30 years later.
Well, let me ask you this real quickly. Is the Jewish Jesus movement before the Jewish Wars, or is it after?
Yeah, it arises, the beginnings of it around 4 BC.
Okay, 4 BC.
And this is where Josephus actually calls it the fourth philosophy. He names all the philosophies. The Essenes were one, the Pharisees were one, the Sadducees were another, and then he mentions the fourth philosophy of Judas the Galilean. I claim that the fourth philosophy of Judas the Galilean was the Jewish Jesus movement.
Okay.
Okay.
Interesting.
So it's just an easy way for people to think, you know, Jewish Jesus versus Gentile Christ, you know, knowing that they were two movements that were working side by side, and one didn't know what the other was doing. And when they did find out, they expelled Paul from the movement.
Okay. So Paul's followers, the Gentiles, were undercutting the Jewish Jesus movement, or what?
They were teaching a totally different message. The Jewish Jesus movement, the fourth philosophy of Judas the Galilean, whatever you want to call it, they wanted to follow the law completely, because they were already in an everlasting covenant with God. They didn't need to create anything new. Their only big thing was they were very nationalist, too. They wanted to expel the Romans from their country. So,
right.
you know, the idea when in the Gospel of Jesus in Luke, he's put to death because he claims to be Messiah, and he refuses to pay taxes to Rome. Well, those were the two things that Judas the Galilean would have been charged with. You know, because refusal to pay taxes to Rome is essentially, you know, you're going to be put to death for that.
Oh, that was punishment by death, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, really. They didn't care what you did with your religion, but if you didn't pay your taxes, you were going to be a dead man.
Wow.
So that's where, they were very serious about collecting taxes.
Okay. You have a section in your book, The Tradition of Paul, and he's a fairly a big figure in your writings. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, now, traditionally, Paul was a bad person to start with. He converts to the Jesus movement, and then he becomes the preeminent apostle. In the writings of Josephus, and from Paul's own writings, were both primary sources, Paul creates his own gospel. Okay, it was a gospel that was created for the Gentiles, and it was no longer to follow the law or to be righteous. It was to become righteous through the blood of Christ. Now, this harkens to the mystery religions of the time, you know, whether or not you want to be a follower of Mithras or different mystery religions. It had nothing to do with the Judaism of the time, which was essentially John the Baptist and Judas the Galilean. They preached to follow the law, you know, that included circumcision and all the other laws. And essentially, Paul said that wasn't important. You know, what he was trying to do is replace Israel with his own movement. He wanted to make the Gentiles the new Israel. And now you can see how the old Israel would react to that. You know, when Peter and James become aware of this, Paul even claims that they all turned their back on him. And that's exactly what they did. And he was forever pushed out of the movement at that point.
Hmm.
And there's also a corresponding episode in the writings of Josephus, which I've included in the book, that is similar to the argument between Peter and Paul at Antioch, where this whole thing comes to a head. So there's confirmation from Josephus on this, too.
You know, one of the things I haven't mentioned to our audience is that you are a medical auditor, and you are uniquely gifted to be able to determine from these documents what is the real story and what is either a plagiarism or a copy or whatever. But I have to say, you must have had quite a few aha moments when you were doing your research.
Oh, really? But, you know, the main thing is the approach. If you approach the New Testament as everything, all the dates and everything as being reliable, you're never going to figure it out. And that's the problem with most scholars. They accept certain dates that are in the New Testament chronology, and that just throws them off the scent. You have to approach everything, you know, and not trusting anything, essentially. and if there are any problems, trying to figure out what where the problems are. So, let me give you an example. In the New Testament, John the Baptist, in the book of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, it says that he comes in the year 28-29 A.D. Okay? Now, if you look into another document called the Slavonic Josephus, they have this same character coming in 6 A.D. Okay, so there's a discrepancy there. Which is right? I don't know, but you at least should look at either one or both of them
right.
to determine. You know, and New Testament scholars don't do that. They essentially just accept the one and don't look at any other piece of information, which is mm-hmm. very, very troubling, because then you come up with some really interesting problems. For instance, in Josephus, John the Baptist dies in 36 A.D. Okay? In the Gospels, John the Baptist dies before Jesus, and Jesus dies in 30 to 33 A.D. So how do you reconcile the death of John in 30 A.D. or so to the Josephus' account in 36? You can't. Under looking at the New Testament chronology. Yet what you have to do is go and see what Josephus says, tie your points to there, and then try to figure out all the other stuff. And that's what I think I've done.
How much of your research... You do. You have a great timeline. But how much of your research do you think, or did you find, was eyewitness? Was there much eyewitness to these... Josephus seems to have taken the some of the people that were eyewitnesses, but none of the chroniclers are eyewitnesses. Is that correct?
The writers of the Gospels. The Gospel writers. I claim Paul wrote Mark, but even he wasn't an eyewitness. Because he met the risen Christ. He didn't meet the actual Messiah figure. So
okay.
Nobody that wrote the Gospels had any connection to the Jewish Jesus movement. They were part of Paul's Gentile movement, and I go through in the book and show you why they weren't associated with the Jewish Jesus movement, you know, point by point.
Well, okay, this gets to the part three of your book, and I'm going to read a short passage here. This is the part three is called The Creation of Jesus of Nazareth. And you start with a short paragraph. You say, "The Jesus of Nazareth we find in the New Testament in the canonical Gospels is not the Jesus of history, but rather a composite. That is, it is a portrait created by Pauline Gentile Christ movement to suit its needs after the Jewish Jesus movement and Judaism waned due to the disastrous Jewish war with Rome in the 60s. A new Messiah figure is needed, worthy of Roman admiration and devotion." Tell me about that. Worthy of Roman admiration and devotion. Is that because they wanted the Romans to also admire this figure? Is that why they created this Jesus of Nazareth?
Now remember, this in the Gentile world, this is the Roman world that Paul was circulating this new Jesus of Nazareth movement. He's not concerned with the Jews. The Jewish movement has essentially been wiped out. There's nobody to bother him anymore. He can do what he wants. And the people he's trying to reach are Romans, whether they be Greek-speaking or whatever. He's trying to reach these people. So you look at the different Gospels, and at the, let's say, when Jesus is crucified, the Jews look on, and, you know, some are saying, you know, snide remarks about him. Who is the one that proclaims that he's the Son of God? The Roman centurion. He's the one that actually sees that Jesus was the Son of God. So, you know, throughout the Gospels, you're having this demonization of the Jewish people, and you have the elevation of the Romans. Even Pontius Pilate, by the time you get into the book of John, becomes a sympathetic character, you know. And mm-hmm. by the histories of the time, he was a nasty individual, you know. So you get these the Romans are kind of excused for the killing of the Messiah, and that blame has now been attached to the Jews. But in fact, it was the Romans who did it. So it's a mm-hmm. total reversal on what actually happened is what we're seeing in the Gospels.
So here's a question for you, and you may not be able to answer this. These Gospels, this book was written, you know, 2,500 years ago, and yet it's only been maybe changed a couple of times, right? The Bible's been changed many times, but the stories kind of stayed the same. And yet this is the foundation for the church. What does this make you, how does this make you feel as a scholar? And I guess I have to ask you, are you still a religious person?
I haven't been a real religious person for quite a while. I grew up Roman Catholic, and I was actually in a fundamental group for about 5 years. So, you know, I read uh-huh. the Bible every day. I taught Bible studies, and yeah, I even preached a few times. So, you know, it's not like I always came at it as, you know, trying to tear it down, because I was always interested in the history of the times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I learned more about the history, you know, some of these other things didn't make a whole lot of sense. So, mm-hmm. you know, I tried to figure out what really went on here, you know, and there were so many things, and a good example, you know, if you're a student of history, the Barabbas prisoner release. Most scholars find it hard to believe that Pontius Pilate, who was a Roman governor, would release a terrorist to the crowd. You know, that the Romans mm-hmm. didn't do that kind of stuff. They crucified the terrorists, you know, like right. Barabbas figure. Now, on the other hand, Josephus talks about a Barabbas prisoner release after Judas the Galilean is imprisoned by Herod the Great. And there's a Barabbas mm-hmm. prisoner release after that. So what I've done is, you know, I'm looking at these and I go, well, you know, it's impossible. It would not have happened under Pilate, but yet it did happen right after Herod the Great died. So, you know, I'm trying to look at things, the probabilities, too, of why, how things could happen in one era and not in another. And the New Testament has a tendency to take things out of context. They put things in different time frames, and they just do not make sense. And what I've tried to do is make sense of all of it.
So Jesus of Nazareth was a creation, and according to your scholarly research, Judas the Galilean was the true figure of the day, who was an actual person, and they just rewrote his story and embellished it and made this Jesus of Nazareth. Is that correct?
Yeah, essentially it was Judas the Galilean infused with the teachings of Paul, because mm-hmm. in the Gospels you have Jesus roaming around pretending to be a Messiah figure. At the same time, he's telling his disciples on the side, oh, and by the way, I'm going to be put to death and then rise on the third day. Now, this is Pauline mm-hmm. theology that's being put into the mouth of a Messiah figure that is trying to get rid of Rome. So mm-hmm. it's not realistic in the way it's presented in the gospel, but you can see that there is a historical person, Judas the Galilean, behind a kind of framework, but then there's this Pauline character that's kind of layered on top of him. So you mm-hmm. get this unbelievable character, and that's why some people don't believe that there was ever a Jesus a Messiah figure to start with. Because it is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But yet, I really do believe there was a historical person behind the whole thing, which was Judas the Galilean.
What does this say about the future of the church and religion if there's hundreds of millions or tens of millions of people who pray to a Jesus that's a fictitious character. I mean, in the evolution of religion, and you may not be able to answer this, how, if this comes out and it grows and it grows and it grows and becomes news, what do people do? Do they refute your evidence? Does the church evolve the story? What's the future of this?
I'm sure a lot of people will, you know, jump down my throat, but I welcome that because I really think I've got the facts on my side. So I have no problem with that. How is it going to affect the churches? A lot of people won't believe what I'm saying. That's fine.
But
what the whole thing boils down to, the original movement of Judas the Galilean, of John the Baptist, they taught people to be good people. Okay, to follow, to them, to be a good person was to follow the law, to love God, to love your neighbor as yourself. That was paramount to them. Now, I don't think that what I'm saying is going to hurt how people act or how they treat each other. If they went back to the original, they'd probably act a lot better than they do today. So I don't see how it's going to be a negative thing at all. So you can go into any church today and find good people and not so good people. But that's not going to change with what I've written.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay. The book's fantastic. I want to read the name of the book again for the audience. It's Judas of Nazareth, How the Greatest Teacher of First Century Israel Was Replaced by a Literary Creation. And it's a fascinating book. I want to thank you for being on the show, Daniel. Where can people get this book on Amazon now? Where can they get the book?
Well, really, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Barnes & Noble. You can go to a local bookstore. If they don't have it, you can have them order it.
Okay.
Probably the easiest thing is Amazon, but it's on, you know, probably hundreds of different sites. So.
Okay. Now, and does the publisher have you on a speaking tour in different parts of the country? Where can we hear about you? Where can we hear you speak?
Right now, it's mostly through interviews like what we were doing today.
Okay.
Hopefully, as time goes on, if the book gets some traction, I'll, you know, be able to do some speaking. So.
Okay. It's fascinating. I think it's amazing what you've discovered. If you were to have a prediction of what the results of your research would be, what would you say would be? What would you like to see as an outcome of your book? If you could kind of project for the next year or so,
I would like to just have some of the scholarly community look at it. It took me 8 years before I had the first scholar look at it. Barry Wilson, he wrote the foreword to the book. He started reading my stuff 2011 or so, but I first started writing in 2004. It took me 7 or 8 years to get the first scholar to read it, and he liked it, and he wrote the foreword to it. So, you know,
it's going to take
a while to get more scholars, because it's not easy to say what I've been teaching or what I've been believing is not right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's much easier to just either ignore or to defend what you're believing. So it's going to take time, but I'm hoping that as time goes on, you know, people will be more willing to at least look at the ideas.
Okay. Wow, fantastic. Well, hey, thank you for being on the show, and much luck. I think that you have the foundations for some really eye-opening discussion, if not some earth-shattering possibilities. So I appreciate you being on the show. So again, the book is Judas of Nazareth, How the Greatest Teacher of the First Century Israel Was Replaced by a Literary Creation, by Daniel Utterbrink. So fantastic. Thanks again for being on the show. Next week, we will be discussing a book called The Yugas, and our guest will be Joseph Siebel, and he is going to be talking about Sri Yukteswar and his research into the ancient history of the world and how that affects us today. So we look forward to having you on the program again. Have a good day.